Hi, I'm Roxanne Amico, and you're listening to Radio Roxanne, a production of Spirit Morph Studio and Earthstream Creative Projects Incorporated. This segment, Green is Green, kicks off a new series of interviews, Rad Rocks the Roots, sowing narrative seeds to cultivate a future of justice and sustainability. A series sharing voices and visions of people with a deep critique of the current culture. What's at stake in the battles we're facing, the forces we're up against, and what we can do. Today's segment is an interview with Josh Harper, an anarchist from Oregon. Josh was one of the Shack 7, which stands for Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, an international animal rights campaign initiated in the Pacific Northwest in the early 2000s to shut down Huntington Life Sciences, a UK research organization infamously known for testing harmful medical and non-medical substances on tens of thousands of animals every year. Josh Harper spoke at Burning Books in Buffalo, New York on February 28, 2013 about his experiences working against vivisection for animal liberation and about how people of conscience can resist the power of the state and its corporate sponsors. We interviewed Josh about his identity as an activist, his influences, his mistakes, and what he learned. Since his talk was titled Revolution Before It's Too Late, we also talked about the meaning and forms of revolt and envisioning better possibilities for all life forms. What you're about to hear is 15 minutes or so, primarily of the voice of Josh Harper, and I'll jump in with a few words at the very end.
My name is Josh Harper. I'm an activist from the Pacific Northwest. Politically, I'm most often identified as an anarchist. There's a lot of fields of thought, though, that have influenced my politics over the years. Everything from socialism to environmentalism, animal liberation thought. I try to nowadays more and more find points of unity with other folks than really relegate myself to a single niche.
Do you have a story, something in your life that inspired you?
Absolutely. When I was about 15 years old, I'd say that was right about the time that I first started becoming politicized. There was a thing going on in Oregon. This group called the Oregon Christian Alliance was passing local level ordinances that made it legal to discriminate against gay people. And so schools could fire a teacher for being gay. City governments could bar people from even running for an elected post just for being gay. They were so successful at these local ordinances that they attempted to get a state-level legislation passed that would prevent anyone who was gay from having any public office at all. This was known as Measure 9, and it started a huge fight in the state. Nazi skinheads at the time saw this as an opportunity to make their way in, a way that they could come in and, you know, spread their philosophy of white supremacy. And so they just began flooding into the state. Right around this time, me and my friend Joe were walking on the University of Oregon campus, and we saw an OCA protest going on, this huge crowd of bigots holding their signs. And so we were young, and we were punk rock, and really felt that it was our duty to shock and frighten them. So we walked right into the midst of their protest and embraced each other and kissed. And we had a good laugh about it and left. But what we didn't realize was that there were skinheads at the protest, and they followed us. And, you know, skinheads are typically cowards, and so as we split up and I headed down an alley there on West 13th in Eugene, I got jumped by about three or four skinheads. I got beaten pretty severely. The thing was, is I had a very homophobic father. And when these men left me bleeding and beaten in this alleyway, my main fear was that if I went home, my father would ask me why it had happened. So I waited, and that night when I finally did come home, and as I walked in through our sliding glass door that led to the back deck, I saw my dad beating my dog, Max. Suddenly, something clicked in my head. I saw his pain, and I saw him scrambling and trying to get away and escape that suffering. And suddenly the fact that he couldn't speak or do math was absolutely meaningless to me. I realized that his life was as precious to him as my own, and his suffering was as real to him as my own is to me. And it was this complete shift in consciousness to me. And it was at that point that I started becoming more aware of not just issues of human community, but of the overall biological community and all of the non-human life around us. And that, of course, led me to really investigate our place in the biological community around us and in civilization at large. I think we're at a really unique point in human history right now, because throughout, you know, the last several thousand years, we've seen plenty of examples in human history where people have said, enough is enough, and we are not going to take this anymore. The thing about revolutions is that they're almost always led by a group of people who outnumber their oppressors, people who never could have been held down except for through trickery and deceit and military power. But that military power component nowadays is augmented by something that previous societies haven't really had to deal with, and that is surveillance technologies. I think everyone's sort of aware right now of the fact that the United States government monitors the internet usage of every citizen within its borders. I think we all are sort of aware of surveillance cameras and things like that. I think what many of us are less aware of, however, is that there's not just a function creep to the use of security cameras, but there's a technological capacity that these machines have that keeps becoming more and more and more dangerous. Facial recognition technology has entered the news a lot in the last few years, but what people are less aware of is the goal that the U.S. government has to create cameras that recognize us by our irises, that recognize us by the unique way that we walk, that can recognize us by not only our voice itself, but by our vocalization patterns, by our vocabulary selections, and so on. As computer processing power and storage power has increased, they need fewer and fewer people to monitor greater and greater portions of the population. One of the men who actually invented the first microprocessor, he believes that we are rapidly advancing towards a period where four satellites could essentially monitor the entire population. Once the government has the ability to watch the activities of everyone inside of its borders, and of course this is coupled with the fact that we all have cell phones, we all have web cameras, we have surveillance technologies in our homes that we voluntarily carry and keep with us at all times, this drastically reduces our capacity for revolution. If you've been watching what's happening in Yemen and Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, all over the world right now with these unmanned drones and with other military technologies as well, if revolt became a real thing here in the United States, we wouldn't be worried about pepper spray anymore. We would be worried about missiles. And so I believe that as these technologies become more potent, and in the hands of an elite that are more than willing to kill us to maintain their power and wealth, I believe that we could be essentially nearing the end of the window of possibility for revolution, and it frightens me. So I really want people to consider, you know, what is it going to take to get us to revolt, and how much time do we have left to do so?
So what's at stake?
Human freedom. Human dignity, ecological sanity, the ability of our bioregions to continue to support life on this planet. What's at stake also goes far beyond anything of value to humans. We are one species amongst millions on this planet, and yet somehow we think that we're the only ones entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's absurd. I want a revolution that goes beyond just what's necessary for human life. I want to see a revolution on this planet that ensures the rights of non-humans to live as they want to live, to enjoy their own social structures, to enjoy their own cultures, to live in intact ecosystems that provide them with the maximum amount of wealth and leisure and liberty and happiness. And so all of that's at stake. Right now, we're poisoning the land, we're poisoning the air, we're poisoning the water, we're poisoning our bodies. And I'd say what's most insidious is that through a process of the media being held by fewer and fewer people's hands, and hands that are sociopathic, we're seeing our mental health being poisoned as well. We're seeing our community response being poisoned, our ability to feel warmth and compassion towards each other. And so this revolt that I'm talking about, it's not just a revolt of the proletariat against the bourgeoisie or against, you know, of one class against the ruling class. This is a revolt of all life on Earth against the tiny percentage of those that would subjugate us for financial profit. I'd say that that if we can win, and I believe that we can, I'd say that if we can win, there's a whole realm of possibilities out there that are so much more exciting and just and humane than what we're currently being offered. Here's the very difficult thing for revolutionaries to admit. No one really knows what to do. A lot of revolutionaries try to present revolution as some kind of science, as some sort of set method that, you know, if we follow step A and step B, we'll end it at, you know, step C. I haven't really found that to be the case, you know. Social ecologists think they have the way, but they sure haven't sparked a revolution yet. Left communists, right communists, socialists, anarcho-feminists, everyone sort of uses this historically deterministic thinking to say that, well, because the revolution against the Tsar happened this way, or because May 68 in France happened this way, or because the Spanish Civil War happened this way, we can replicate those things. The sad reality is that times change. Our opponent isn't static. They adapt and learn our methodology, and they find ways to prevent avenues of revolt that we've been successful at before. One of the projects that I was involved in and that ultimately sent me to prison was a group called Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. And I was involved in SHAC because I think vivisection is a crime. I think that it is just about the ultimate in human arrogance. I wanted to stop it, but more than that, what I wanted to do was learn methodologies that could attack capital at its base. And what I'll say about us, what made us a threat, what made us something that the United States had to stop, was that we were willing to learn through a course of trial and error. We were willing to say, okay, we need to take tremendous risks. We can see what is not working, and we need to develop a new plan. And we ended up going up against some of the biggest corporations on Earth. In fact, the biggest corporation on Earth, Citibank. And we won. Time after time after time, we were able to force people who were billionaires, people who never, ever would have paid attention to some small town kid from Oregon, we were able to force them to capitulate to our demands. And we did this through a variety of means. We tried a little bit of hacktivism. We tried a little bit of shareholder activism. We did a lot of financial targeting. We did home demonstrations. We did direct action. We did sabotage. But mostly what we did was we kept trying. We kept adding new elements. We kept our opponents on their toes. Unfortunately, we had a lot of hubris. There was a lot of arrogance after a while because we had had some degree of success. And we took an ultra-militant line that unfortunately pushed away a broader base of support. I've learned that we need moderates. We need liberals as much as I find ways to denounce them constantly. We need a larger portion of the population to, if they will not participate, to at least lend support. these are the folks who are going to be there to bail us out. These are going to be the folks who are there to give us jobs when we get out of prison. These are going to be the folks who, when they can, quietly slip us some money. But I think it's that mix of daring, of revolutionary thought, of trial and error, and building a broad base. I think that right now, those are amongst our only hopes. I know none of that is too specific. Sometimes it sounds conveniently broad, and I regret that, but I don't think any of the folks, as I mentioned earlier, who try to present revolution as a science, have shown that their very specific methodology gets us there quicker. One moment that I always think about during the Shaq campaign, funny in hindsight. One morning I was sitting at home and smoking pot and playing video games. Quite a revolutionary. My phone rang, and my friend Joe was on the other line, and he said, "Hey, turn on C-SPAN." So I turn on the television, and Robert Mueller, who was then the FBI's head of counterterrorism, was before Congress. And I'm kind of watching for a little bit, and all of a sudden, he said my name, and he began talking about Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty and some of the people I was involved in the campaign with. And he said, "These names cross my desk every day." It was shortly after that that I got indicted, and the government was trying to portray me as the fourth most important person in the biggest threat to domestic security in the United States. And what was really, really funny about the idea that I was some sort of criminal mastermind was, this is when I had just finally gotten a cell phone for the first time. And I didn't know how to turn the ringtone on and off on it and how to set it to vibrate. And one day it was in my pocket with a bunch of loose change. And somebody called me. And when it went off, it rattled against all the change in my pocket. I thought there was a bee in my pocket. And I was running down the street screaming. And I was the fourth most important person in the biggest threat to the United States of America. We can all participate in the revolution. You don't need a particularly high IQ, and I think I've proven that. And I guess the one thing I would add, and this is going to seem so intuitive that it seems silly to say, but yet, if it's so intuitive, I wonder why so few of us do it. It's clear that we're not at a revolutionary moment here in the United States, you know? And I don't believe that a minority can force change on a majority, at least without massive military strength, which it's also clear that we do not have. And so building to that revolutionary moment is going to require so many of us to do this uncomfortable thing, and that is to talk about controversial politics to our friends and family, to make this something that people discuss. I want all of us, no matter how difficult, no matter how uncomfortable, no matter how conservative our families are, we need to start thinking about what is the entry point, what is the wedge here? Because if we do not build numbers, and soon, as I mentioned earlier, we could lose our window. And once that's gone, I think everything's lost. So it means talking things over with homophobic dad. It means sitting down with your brother who works at the bank and asking him to consider the ills of capitalism. It's going to mean a lot of us having to have an awful lot of uncomfortable conversations, but those are conversations that are absolutely necessary if we hope to spark something larger.
That was the voice and vision of Josh Harper talking about the urgent need to revolt while there's still time. I'd like to thank Josh for a talk. Even though his voice was raw from a bad cold, he was generous and his vision spirited. A brief addendum here. In Josh's story about his dog Max, I refrained from asking the obvious follow-up question. Then what happened? I didn't ask because I was caught up in the emotional trajectory of the story. However, later, when Josh talked at the bookstore, he shared with the audience that moment of realization, in which he became cognizant of his kinship with all other forms of life. What happened next was that he intervened on behalf of his beloved companion, Max. It was the first time he went up against his father's abuse.
Josh shared the story at a time when all people and the whole planet are targeted by corporate surveillance and exploitation. A time, for example, when 60% of the 305 migrating bird species of North America have shifted north because of industrial-induced climate change. At this time, before the window closes on the liberation for birds of every feather, I think Josh's story of his personal roots of intervention and political action is a story with wings. I'm Roxanne Amico for Radio Roxanne, a production of Spirit Morph Studio and Earthstream Creative Projects, Incorporated on Wednesday, the 10th of April, 2013. Thanks for listening.